Howdy, folks. I'm fixing to tell y'all about Texas, nicknamed the Lone Star State.
I'm particularly fond of these. I pulled them out of a place on Midgard called Texas.
Don't mess with Texas?
That's the message.
I'm Walker, and I'm Texas Ranger.
Sexy. I mean, anything for Salinas.
Welcome to this week's episode of Texas Slang for Crazy. This episode is on the Texarkana Phantom. You've likely heard of the Black Dahlia Killer and the Zodiac Killer. Texas has its very own and extremely messed up unsolved cold case that still haunts those on the Texas and Arkansas border. In 1946, a small town, Texarkana, became the location of a horrific series of murders by an unidentified masked man. At the end, 5 would be dead, 3 would be extremely traumatized, and a whole town would be sent into a panic. These became known as the Moonlight Murders. The town of Texarkana was a huge mix of pretty much everybody. There was just an explosion of different cultures. And unfortunately, this did lead to a lot of culture clashes and crime on crime. In the 1940s, there were 4 railways offering passenger service into the town, and crime increased with that inflow as well. World War II brought in more people with war industry, and the population increased yet again. So the town already had its own fair share of people running liquor, there were shootouts, robberies, knife fights. Murder wasn't entirely uncommon, and there was even a string of murders the year before the Texarkana Phantom appeared on the scene. The nightmare started February 22, 1946. A young couple in Texarkana had been out at a lover's lane when they were attacked. Sheriff Bill Presley received the call and went to investigate, as it was a pretty quiet night. James Hollis, one of the victims, was so horrifically attacked that he could barely stay conscious. James Hollis and Mary Jean Larry had gone out to lover's lane as they were both in the process of divorcing other people and wanted to maintain their privacy. The police found nothing at the scene but Hollis's pants. With a severely injured skull, Hollis fell into a coma for 15 days. Mary Jean Larry did her best to explain to the officers what they had experienced. While both victims agreed that their attacker was about 6 feet tall, their stories conflicted. Mary Jean Larry thought it was a light-skinned black man. Hollis later would say that he thought it was a dark-skinned white man. And while both the victims agreed that their attacker was about 6 feet tall and that he wore a pillowcase cut out for eyes, they really couldn't identify who it might have been. Neither recognized the man at all, and they just thought at first that it was a policeman because when they were on scene, they were blinded by his flashlight. They figured, hey, you know, we're on Lover's Lane, we're probably getting caught by the cops and telling us to move along. But they figured out pretty quickly that it was a masked man with a gun. He told them to stay in the car, and Hollis and Larry both immediately stated that they didn't have any cash on them and tried to show the attacker this. The attacker insisted they were lying and ordered them out of the car. Hollis was ordered to take his pants off, and then the Phantom hit him in the head with the butt of his gun, which left 2 deep fractures in the man's skull. According to BuzzFeed Unsolved, it's rumored that the cracks were so loud that Mary Jean Larry thought Hollis had been shot. The attacker told Larry to run, and when she did, he caught up to her and asked her why she ran. When she said that he had told her to, he punched her and did some pretty horrible things to her with his gun. He likely would have killed her, but headlights appeared in the distance, so he punched Larry one last time and left. The story of this attack appeared in the Texarkana Gazette on February 23rd. The sheriff went to speak with Larry's estranged husband, but he was able to give a pretty good alibi, showing that he was really far away from the crime scene. Despite the brutality of the crime, very little was done to try and find a suspect, and they just kind of assumed that the attack could be typical for the area, so a major manhunt was deemed not necessary. It was also pretty clear that due to the racial tensions in the town, not really having a solid clue of who could have attacked would just cause more problems. So Texarkana lucked out for about 30 days. There wasn't really much going on. But on March 24th, 2 bodies were found in a car parked on a quiet street. First responders and law enforcement arrived and a large crowd started to surround the scene, which is not great. When the tow truck showed up to remove the car, officers didn't wear gloves. They ended up
marking things so severely with their own fingerprints that fingerprints from the crime scene could not be collected. One of the police at the crime scene picked, or people actually, was a stand, somebody was nearby, picked up the keys that they found 100 yards away from the vehicle with their bare hands and handed them to the cops. The murdered couple ended up being identified as Richard Griffin and Polly Ann Moore. Both had been shot in the head with a .32 caliber gun. There was blood found outside the vehicle indicating that the couple had been killed outside of it and then moved back into the car. Richard Griffin was found with his pockets turned out and Polly Ann Moore's purse had been ruffled through. And there are unfortunately conflicting reports over whether Polly Ann Moore had been raped. That's going to be kind of something that you see throughout these murders. And there was an argument over whether it was a robbery because they found Griffin's wallet and Moore's class ring at the scene. The sheriff ended up giving in and contacted the Texas Rangers to try and help identify the gun used and to help with ballistics. And the ranger that showed up was Jimmy Greer, and he told off the local police department like nobody's business. He's like, "What are you doing? You didn't secure the scene. You touched things without gloves. What are we supposed to do now?" He was able to get some evidence to the ranger lab in Austin, and they determined that the gun used was likely a Colt, so Colt 32. On April 14th, the killer struck again. Betty Jo Booker was supposed to be spending the night at a friend's house after playing her saxophone at a local VFW hall. For those of you not in the United States, that's Veterans of Foreign War halls. There's usually local activities there, dances, you can rent them out for weddings and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And when Betty Jo Booker didn't show back up to her friend's house that night or go home, her mom started panicking and calling around. A family was driving on North Park Road about 6 a.m. the next day, and they saw a body on the side of the road, and they panicked and drove to the closest home and called the police. Now, unfortunately, it wasn't Betty Jo Booker. It was a young man named Paul Martin. They found him lying on his side. The only reason they were able to identify him is because of his ID and his wallet. He'd been shot 4 times. And his car was actually found about a mile away with the keys in the ignition. And even though the sheriff found his date book kind of thrown in the bushes, he took Paul Martin's date book, put it in his back pocket, and just kind of forgot about it. Didn't, you know, process it. And so people started getting panicky because they realized that Paul Martin was the last person who was with Betty Jo Booker. They had been seen together. So panic started spreading. The FBI was called in, and they were just desperately looking for her. But unfortunately, Betty Jo Booker's body was found less than 2 miles from Paul Martin. She was shot twice. She was fully clothed. Again, there were conflicting reports over whether or not she was raped. The bullet casings and the bullets matched those that were found at the other crime scene. So 6 more Texas Rangers show up to help. And the Texarkana Gazette nicknamed the attacker the Phantom Killer. So that's where we get that. It shows up in the paper. And then we get another nickname to show up on the scene. There was Texas Ranger Captain Manuel Trazas Lone Wolf Gonzalez. Okay, that's a mouthful to say. He'd been with the Rangers for 26 years. And he had a reputation, Lone Wolf, for going out after outlaws on his own. He supposedly killed 75 outlaws, and they were all justified, according to the Texas Rangers. He ended up going, okay, well, you know, if Betty Jo was killed, she likely had her saxophone with her from the VFW hall. We're going to call all the local pawn shops. They were calling pawn shops as far as Corpus Christi. So just so y'all get a better idea of that, that's like all the way down the state. Texarkana was running out of deadbolts, braces for doors, guns, ammunition. People were panicking. A curfew was placed on the town and people started traveling in groups. Local criminals and quite a few innocent people got swept into the craziness and were brought to local police stations for investigation. And the FBI and Texas Rangers started setting up stings at lovers' lanes to try and see if they could get the Phantom to show up. Local groups started gathering money. They were like, hey, you know, we are going to give everything we can to try and capture this guy. And I will say this one's probably the saddest. The Stark family 100% did not deserve what happened to them on May 3rd, 1946. Virgil Stark was sitting at home in the front room with the curtains open. His back was hurting. He had a heating pad and he was just trying to relax. And his wife, Katie, had gone into the other room to get into bed. And while she was there, she hears this loud noise and she rushes to the front room and finds that Virgil has been shot from outside of the living room. And as she rushes to go to the telephone, she is shot twice, once with a bullet ending up under her tongue. She dropped to the floor to try to avoid any more bullets. She crawled to the bedroom to grab their gun. But unfortunately, at that point in time, the attacker came running into the house. She was very smart, and Katie was able to escape and went to a neighbor's house where they rushed her to the hospital. When she was admitted, police rushed to the home to secure the scene. Bloodhounds were brought in to find the attacker, but as is the theme of this story, there were so many officers arriving on the scene, it became impossible for the dogs to narrow down one single scent. They did actually find the attacker's flashlight and a size 10 shoe brin. Now, the weird thing about the Stark killing is that, well, Virgil passed away, Katie did survive. A lot of it didn't line up with previous killings, but it's still credited to the Texarkana Phantom. So now we have not only Texarkana in a full panic, but towns as far away as Little Rock, Arkansas, are filled with people who are locking themselves in as soon as the sun is going down, right? They're holding guns. So in June 1946, Life magazine publishes an article on the terror in Texarkana, and this makes it a nationally known crime. Residents of the town started setting up booby traps in their houses. Unfortunately, a lot of this led to injuries for people who lived in the houses. Many accidentally shot neighbors or visitors, and if somebody was coming to visit, you made them wait and you made them identify themselves before they got anywhere near the house. It was so bad that when men were traveling for work, their families often would just go and stay in a hotel because it was just, we're not leaving, being home by ourselves. So tons of people are arrested, brought in, asked to be talked to. There was even one guy who killed himself and left a note saying that he had been the Texarkana Phantom. But there is one person who leads as the main suspect for the murders. Yule Lee Sweeney was a small town crook who had recently gotten married. He was known for theft and then reselling stolen items. His new wife was brought in for questioning after she tried to pick up their impounded vehicle that had been left in a lot, and it belonged to Sweeney. She wasn't able to give decent alibis for Sweeney on the dates of the murders, and she had also stashed away a bloody towel after Sweeney returned one night to their hotel after midnight covered in blood. She had multiple details that only the police were privy to at this time, including the date book being thrown into the bushes, the date book that the sheriff forgot about. Circumstantial evidence pointed to Sweeney as a likely murderer, and he also had in his possession a shirt labeled with Virgil Stark's name. His wife advised that at one point in time they'd had the saxophone in their home, but they still did not have enough evidence that could make the case stick. So Sweeney ended up being put in jail for lesser crimes. Pretty damning is the fact that the murders stopped after this. So he was in jail for lesser crimes. 26 years later, he filed a successful appeal, and he died a free man in a Dallas nursing home at the age of 77. The case has never officially been solved. So one of the really weird things, this case is already bizarre as heck, right? There is a story that family members of the victims continue to receive calls, and they haven't in a few years from what I can tell, but they were getting calls from an unidentified woman who kept apologizing for the murders completed by her father and then would hang up the phone, and no one knows who she is. What's interesting about that is you see something like that with the Black Dahlia killer. There is a young woman, well, she's not a young woman anymore, but there was a young woman who claimed that she was his daughter and that she knew he was killing people. It was a whole thing. So anyway, this goes on. We hit the 70s. And in 1976, a horror movie was made based on the crimes. It was called The Town That Feared Sundown. It was extremely popular. It was not dead on with the facts, which, shocking, most movies aren't. But in 2003, Texarkana decided to reclaim themselves, and they started doing screenings of the film at the Spring Lake Park in Texarkana, Texas. What's weird about this is the site is not far from where the first attacks happened, and the screening is so popular, it's now a regular Halloween destination for tourists. And they sometimes play the original 1976 movie, sometimes they play the 2014 remake, which is even farther off the facts. But it's how they make some tourist dollars and try to reclaim the horrors from that. What's crazy too is in 2020, while we were all in lockdown and doing our own thing, the FBI released about 1,000 pages of documents in relation to the murders, and they are fascinating. There's a whole bunch of things about, if you've ever wanted to know what like an FBI document looks like or what a dossier looks like, or hey, we're just gonna send this memo out real quick, we think the guy might be 6 foot. It's so weird to see, but it's really interesting. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I know it's rambly, I know it's long, but it's just one of those cases that's still mind-blowing out to Texas. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you soon.